Welcome back to Plot Pit. Today, in the pit, I'm sitting here with local author John LeMay, author of over 40 books. Hello, John. How you doing?
It's Sunday, Bloody Sunday, for us at least, because we're keeping with the vampires for two episodes in a row.
Oh, yes. Continuing episode 6. This is going to be fun. Blood sucked away. Engineer meets unusual death in a Chicago plant. Chicago, May 12th. By having almost every drop of blood drawn from his body when his leg was caught in a suction pipe, Walter Hunter, engineer employed by the Armorin Company, was killed Saturday while repairing a power plant. A post-mortem examination showed that Hunter's heart had shriveled up, his lungs were flat and empty, and there was scarcely any trace of blood in the organs in the upper part of the body. Several of the arteries in Hunter's leg were broken by suction. Now, if you imagine a vampire, what it would do to your body, here you go.
Yeah, and so that was basically very similar to the article from the last episode, right? But it's not the same article.
Correct. The previous article was entitled Vampire Pipe.
Mm-hmm.
And so this is the instigating article from the Iowa Democrat that the Mountaineer article had picked up on, and another author expanded on it.
So it is the same incident, just a different... Okay, gotcha.
Correct. And so this one comes out of the Iowa Democrat from Mineral Point, Wisconsin, specifically page 3, about the middle of page 3. Iowa County Democrat, Mineral Point, Wisconsin, Thursday, May 16, 1907.
Okay, so yeah, last episode when William brought that up and he said Mineral Point, Wisconsin, that flashed in my brain the Mineral Point vampire. And that was a thing really in the early 1980s. There was a cop who had a sighting of basically like a Bela Lugosi, Christopher Lee looking guy roaming around a cemetery. You know, just your stereotypical vampire with the cape, the white caked on face makeup. And this thing was seen a couple of times. And as people researched it, they discovered something from the same area from the 1800s that they called the Ridgeway Phantom. It was more of a ghost than a vampire, but people have kind of tied them together. But and again, you know, last episode was all about Comte de Saint-Germain, the alleged vampire of New Orleans.
And this was 1904.
1904 in that case. And now, when we go up to Mineral Point, Wisconsin, that's very close to Illinois, and I have another related story. So, Saint Germain had a disciple named Guy Ballard who threatened to destroy Chicago with a herd of ghost steers. So, I felt like between the Mineral Point vampire in Wisconsin and then this weird guy Ballard in Illinois, you know, they're close enough, we could maybe work with that. And then the industrial accident in that same area, so I'm sure we can spin something off of those three elements, and we've got more as backups if we need.
So as a recap from episode 6, we have this Louisiana legend of this count in New Orleans who allegedly is a vampire. He's discovered because he chases this woman out of a window, and she claims, after she runs to the police, that the count had bit her. And later, upon investigation, it's rumored that the police had found bloodstains in various areas of the home, including a bottle that was half mixed with blood and wine, correct?
Correct. And so where we pick up this story, you know, Count Saint Germain, actually it's Comte. I don't know what Comte even means, but yeah, Comte Saint Germain. So he disappears, and people claim to see him throughout time. And one of these people is basically a shyster, a con man named Guy Ballard. And he said that he was hiking on Mount Shasta, California. That'll ring a few bells for our listeners who are into the supernatural and paranormal. Mount Shasta is a location that's notorious for all sorts of odd spiritual things. And so Ballard was hiking on the mountain. I forget the year. It was probably the 1920s, 1930s, somewhere in there. And Ballard claims that Germain appears to him. And what's so interesting is Germain offers to him what he called an electrifying drink in a goblet.
Interesting.
He doesn't say what it was, but I mean, when he says electrifying, and considering that Germain was alleged to have these half wine, half blood bottles in his New Orleans home, you know, makes me think, you know, assuming that Ballard didn't just make the whole thing up, let's pretend like it's real. You know, what did Germain give him? Was it a blood-infused drink that invigorated him? Kind of like something along the lines of adrenochrome or something.
Or the goblet stem could be a lightning rod.
Oh, I like that too.
Okay.
And well, then I was trying to think, how would we tie the goblet to last episode? And we played around with the idea that the industrial accident was like this machine created by vampires to suck people's blood.
Yeah, the human slurpy machine.
That, exactly. That was a great name. So maybe it's more than just like a human juicer slurping machine. Maybe it does something to the blood to make it even more invigorating to the vampires or something. But anyways, that's another rabbit hole to go down.
Now, do we have any backstory at all on this Ballard guy?
Yeah, I've already forgotten what it was, but he was a shyster, and I'll fill in the details of the rest of his life, because basically this alleged encounter with Germain just defined the rest of his existence up until his death. So he basically became a cult leader, and his cult was called the I Am Movement. And it wasn't exactly like a Christian, you know, like God says I am that I am type of thing. It was like kind of like one of those deals about the self-empowerment, the God within you type thing, and they called it the I Am Movement.
So we're almost thinking about the Hail Bop Comet cult type.
Yeah, it was very crazy, and a lot of negative energy in it, because they would often talk about destroying their enemies. Ballard, he did amass a decent amount of followers in the Illinois, Chicago area, and they would get together and chant, annihilate, annihilate, and they would say their enemy's name. And this was in the late 1930s, I do remember that. This is what put Ballard on my radar. Was I was investigating the idea of ghost cattle and ghost steers, and Ballard was trying to curse the Chicago stockyards with a herd of ghost ghost steers and ghost pigs or something. It was really weird.
This almost has an undertone or a potential source for Johnny Cash's Riders in the Sky song.
Yes, and I can briefly relate the real history of that as well, because that is based on a real incident too. But yeah, back to Ballard. He also had this reputed lake of gold somewhere under the ground that he claimed he could somehow harvest, and that was how he swindled people out of their money. He was like, okay, we need to harvest this lake of gold, and if you invest in it and we can build the machine to harvest this underground lake or something like that. And so eventually a woman did sue him, and then that's when things kind of started to go south for him. He went off, he and his wife, I think, ran off to Santa Fe, New Mexico. He eventually died, but the problem with Ballard was he claimed that he was the immortal disciple of Germain, so he couldn't die. So his wife had to claim that instead of dying, he really just ascended.
So we've got this cult leader, Ballard.
Yeah.
And we have an industrial machine accident in a food processing plant taking the life of a gentleman by the name of Hunter, where all of his blood is drained.
Mm-hmm.
And we've got this Louisiana legend of a vampire,
mm-hmm,
all mixed together with Mineral Point, Wisconsin, and flash forward, this cop sees a mysterious figure.
Yeah, vampire.
And what information do we have on that incident?
Well, just to be clear, it was more like 1981 that I remember. And again, it was just a cop saw this man who looked just like a vampire, was dressed like one, but he performed some superhuman feats, kind of like he jumped really high into the air and things like that. Some people have actually likened this Mineral Point vampire to the story of Mothman. Some people know the Mothman story from 1967, that Mothman was basically an omen or a harbinger of doom, and then they had this Silver Bridge collapse in West Virginia, and they just figured Mothman was the omen to this. Well, people have tried to figure out what was the Mineral Point vampire an omen to, and someone brought up that there was the assassination attempt on Reagan shortly after that, so they think, oh, maybe that was an omen, but I think they're just grasping at straws.
For our listeners who are potentially unaware, there is a movie, I think there even is a sequel to it, called Mothman, and it's based upon that legend.
Yeah, it's called The Mothman Prophecies with Richard Gere, and it's based on the real-life 1967 incident.
Yeah, really interesting movie, mm-hmm, actually.
Yeah, and actually the movie, unlike what we're doing here today, the movie is supposedly completely based on the truth, believe it or not. Again, you know, William and I are just taking potentially real stories, maybe we should say real folklore or real lies that people made up, and we're making stories out of it.
Basically using the historical record or rumors of what the historical record was as starting points for writing prompts.
Yeah, so where I'm going with this one is, you know, I kind of look at this as a sequel to last episode where we had Comte Saint-Germain. And the way I see it is, Germain, we never really fleshed out our movie or story last week. So I would say how our story should have ended was with Germain being defeated. He finally gets killed just like Dracula. But like Dracula, you know, he's got a disciple out there who wants to resurrect him. So that's how I look at Ballard. Ballard's end game is he's got to resurrect Saint Germain somehow. And maybe these machines play into that, these industrial accident machines. I don't know.
My head goes to the goblet.
Mm-hmm.
So if the goblet was the means to give Ballard mm-hmm. immortality or something of that nature, and I don't know, let's presume that the stem of the goblet was indeed a lightning rod, so it was not just a potion of concoction, but a zapping of electricity at high voltages simultaneously created this thing. He's trying to perform the research necessary to basically revive a vampire which has been properly killed with the stake through the heart, okay, using the goblet and the potion, which he doesn't know the key to.
Yeah.
So he's become, say, a chemist. And in order to fund his research, this is where all the swindling comes in.
Good idea. I do think Ballard should have inherited some supernatural powers, though.
We could go down the path that Ballard was turned into a vampire himself. And he's now tapped into the vampire community. And the question then becomes, the vampire society, are they trying to also resurrect Comte? And if so, now it's become a question about vampires being able to resurrect themselves. In the event that the humans actually stage a war and control them or overthrow them or something.
Yeah.
So now what you could have is the flipping of the food chain and the fear of that and prepping of, say, the end of the trilogy. So like if you were to think about this as book one, that's all about Germain. Book two is all about Hunter. Mm. It's the darkest of the three. And then in book three, you've got the human vampire war. So kind of staging it at a large act one through act three story arc. And so this is kind of that there's this tension. The humans have found out about vampires because of the incidents that happened with Germain. There's this growing concern. Now you've got Hunter out there, or not Hunter, excuse me.
Ballard.
Ballard out there. And his goal is to figure out how to revive all of these vampires, which are getting knocked off by vampire hunters.
The reason William mentioned Hunter is we have this interesting backup article, too, that I guess we probably don't need it, but it, maybe we ought to save it for another time, about the guy who lost the key to the asylum or something.
Well, we could toss that in there. So since it's already been brought up, I'll land it. Actually, I was referring to Hunter, the guy at the armor plant that had
His name was Hunter. Okay. His name was Hunter. Forgot that already.
However, this particular article that John had just mentioned is right here. Employee who lost mental asylum key is free to hunt. William P. Higgins, an attendant at the New Jersey Mental Hospital, wasn't so concerned about the drunk charge against him. He was worried, he told the municipal judge, as to the whereabouts of the master key to the institution. Quote, there are 6,100 patients who may get loose if I can't find the key, Higgins mourned. So we have this mental asylum attendant who loses the key to the castle. And it basically puts a bit of a panic in the municipal county courts where this guy had gone out hunting and lost the key out there and ended up with a public drunkenness or public intoxication charge.
And where was this story again?
So this one comes from, again, chroniclingamerica.gov. This is a very fun site with all of these old newspapers. But in particular, this one is the Evening Star, Washington, D.C., Thursday, November 25th, 1954.
And does it say like the state where this the guy lost the key to the asylum?
New Jersey.
New Jersey, okay.
So it's an East Coast thing.
Yeah.
But it's close to Washington, D.C. And as that goes through, you could tie it into some form of the federal government where we have gone previously in episode 6 with the budding intelligence agencies now that we're into the 50s. So we're kind of spanning early 1900 with the initiating incident of 1904 in New Orleans to 1981 with this cop in Wisconsin. Mm. So we've got Ballard in the 20s and the 30s. We've got this 50s incident of the missing key to the asylum. And then we've got this sighting again in 81. So you could be doing some time hopping, or not necessarily time travel, but the vampires, because they're immortal, they're thinking long game.
Mm.
And humans have a very short lifespan in comparison. But because humans have figured out the vampires exist and are a threat, we have all these vampire hunters. Could be that the CIA or FBI has a covert X-Files task force designed or specifically implementing with the military to take out the said vampire threat.
Hmm. Well, okay. So we talked about a trilogy with Germain and New Orleans, 1904. And then part two would be like Ballard the Disciple. So maybe part three kicks off with the escaped inmates or something in 1950, whatever. And they had something to do with the vampires. It could even be the case of like Dracula had Renfield the Madman, who wasn't exactly a vampire himself. He was just kind of this crazy guy who fell under Dracula's spell.
A thought. Ballard dies, but he's immortal.
Mm-hmm.
So what if that goblet was only part of the process? Mm. And when he crawled out of his grave, for whatever reason that put him there, he lost all of his memory.
Ah.
And so he's one of these, not insomniacs, excuse me, the amnesia individuals that ends up getting shuffled around through the system and put over into New Jersey.
Yeah.
And over the course of a decade or two, coming out of the 30s, 40s into 1954, when the key's lost, his memory is slowly coming back as his body is slowly regenerating.
Mm, I like it. Yeah. And that's how you tie Ballard back into it. Maybe the so-called Mineral Point vampire is Saint Germain when he first gets rejuvenated, and that's why he's running around like a typical vampire or something. And then he you know, Germain kind of regains his dignity and his powers and all that. And
that's assuming Ballard was able to get the concoction of the goblet together in order to resurrect the dead body of the vampire. So I was actually going down the idea that it was his wife that puts him in the ground. She's the one who eventually discovers that, wait a second, he's up and out, tries to track him down, does the research necessary to locate him in D.C., or excuse me, Jersey, at this mental asylum, and she's the one who swipes the key of the mental asylum's attendant out in the woods late at night on a hunting trip.
Could be.
So now we've got this missing key that's floating around, but it was actually jacked by Ballard's wife, who then unlocks the mental asylum.
Mm-hmm.
And not that the mental asylum key was actually used to release these patients in the true historical record, but for the fictitious purposes here,
yeah.
She releases the mental asylum patients, and now he is one of the ones that doesn't get caught, rounded back up. And from there, that's where they go off again, picking up with the research that they left off in the 30s and all of the swindling, and discover how the goblet actually works.
Yeah. Maybe even tie in the Reagan assassination in there too. You never know.
Now that would be an interesting idea. But if we go down the route with the FBI or CIA having a covert task force to eliminate the vampire threat, Reagan then fits.
Yep, that would work. And okay, here's another fun little connection then. So there was the rumor that Germain never died. So it's kind of like now we've got to revamp our story. So there was this rumor that Germain in the 1970s was this actor, and then Reagan was an actor. So what if Reagan and Germain knew each other, and that played into the attempted assassination somehow?
Okay. It could be at odds.
Mm-hmm.
Reagan on one of the sets in the 1950s when he was, you know, quasi-active in the acting community. I think Reagan got a start in the 30s, the 40s.
I just know him from Bedtime for Bonzo or something, right?
I'm not familiar with that particular one. I'm not familiar much with Reagan's acting history. Yeah. I just know that he was an actor.
Uh-huh.
Although, we could just go down somewhere along the path during Reagan's acting career. He came across Germain,
mm-hmm.
and saw him bloodletting a victim on the set.
Yeah.
So that would tie that in if we wanted to play it that way. So we have Ballard, who's disciple of Germain, and somewhere around the Mount Shasta area, it's rumored Germain appears, converts this guy, gives him a goblet, mm-hmm. and from there we have sprung into the idea of, all right, let's revive Germain, who was killed, say, by some vampire hunters at some point, or there was some other means of death. There's a vampire society now exposed, and we have covert federal agents that are vampire hunters, or maybe the federal government is infiltrated with the vampires, and we have a citizens' resistance corps. You could go down that dystopian world idea, yeah. especially if your larger manufacturers and your food processing plants, such as Armour and Company, which is a legitimate company out of the time period of the early 20s, there was a lot of scandals within that, and they might have been one that got wrapped up in the Sinclair research that had happened during that time period, which also spawned a lot of the food and drug, the FDA stuff. That's a different game, but the Armour and Company did have some scandals. There's a lot of newspaper articles dedicated to whether or not they were trying to corner the market and such. And it happens to be that the Armour and Company owned the facility where our Walter Hunter died, and his blood was sucked dry because of that industrial accident. So the thought is the federal government could be in cahoots with the big players of these manufacturing kingpins, the titans of industry. And now you go into this citizens resistance group, which could have been spawned by a small core set of individuals, which were considered conspiracy theorists, that eventually spawns the era of vampire hunters going, you know, across 50 years to 100 years in the arc of the trilogy.
Yeah. Well, I'm always a big fan of vampire hunter films and like John Carpenter's vampires or the old Hammer films with Peter Cushing as Van Helsing were always a favorite of mine. So
now we could go back to the 1904 incident with the woman that ran out of the window at Germain's place. She could be the heroine of the whole story. And we hit on that in the previous episode. So let's dive just a little bit into her. She discovers what Germain truly is. She's now trying to expose it. She goes to the police. The police don't do anything for whatever reason. Now she becomes an underground figure hiding in fear of her life and decides eventually, I'm going to have to take this guy out.
Yeah, actually, yeah, and we could go the route of the League of Extraordinary Gentlemen, because in there, I don't know if it's like this in the comics, but in the film version with Sean Connery, they don't have Dracula in it, but they have Mina Harker is in it, and Mina Harker is basically a vampire now, but she's like a superhero good vampire, so maybe this girl that jumped out of the balcony, she got bit, and she is a vampire now, but she's going to do her best to take down the other vampires.
So, yeah, the converted vampire, kind of the blade idea, right? If we were to take that concept, who else would she be interested in or run across in the story arc of her line that would bring together or bring about a core group of freedom fighters? Are there any other individuals that you're aware of in the rumor or historical archives of either claiming to have seen vampires or be an escapee of one?
Probably. I just have to reread all the research I did because it's hard to recall all those different dates and whatnot.
And this is what happens when you put somebody on the spot on the air. So let's just invent somebody. If we have another Lady of the Night in New Orleans that had a similar experience with the same individual, she could be an expert in voodoo.
Yeah, and also, though, I mean, if, let's say our heroine is a vampire now and she's immortal, you know, this could have happened many years later. So we could tie her in with the story of the Richmond vampire from the 1920s, which is most likely just folklore, but they have this story that in Richmond, Virginia, they had a tunnel collapse. All these men were working on a train, and then they claim they saw a vampire amidst the wreckage, and it ran off into the cemetery. It's a fairly famous vampire story as well, so it could be like a victim of the Richmond vampire. Maybe she teams up with them or something.
Now, in one of our previous episodes, several back, actually, we had the collapsed mine in Pennsylvania. So what we could end up with here is a vampire society that stays underground and uses these ancient tunnels that exist throughout the whole of the world. So then you could tie back into, say, Admiral Byrd or some of those other Arctic explorers, and the hollow earth theory pops into play here, and the center of the earth is the mecca of the vampires.
I like it. And there's enough, you know, quote unquote, true vampire stories. You could do a whole movie just on those and kind of weave them together in some weird way.
So there's all sorts of possibilities and different angles that you could take this. And of course, Hollywood already has. We're not the first to even attempt such an endeavor, but it's still fun. Still an enjoyable mythos to play around in.
Yeah, anyone who writes and outlines will understand our crazy process. Anybody who doesn't write might just think, wow, these guys are crazy, because you're not sticking with your ideas and you're going from this to this. But that's how it works. When you work with someone, you toss the ball, the idea is the ball, you toss it. They kind of fumble around with it for a minute. They toss it back and change it, you know. So that's just what me and William are doing. That's how it works. I watched the Duffer Brothers of Stranger Things. They did a master class on their writing process. And it's very similar, just them talking. They come out with the crazy idea, and then the other one will kind of give their own little slant to it, and they'll twerk it. And, you know, you have something completely different than what you started with. So I guess our core concepts, though, are just this immortal vampire, Saint Germain, who may or may not have ever died, his disciple Ballard, who definitely swindled a lot of people out of money, and then we've got the Mineral Point vampire of the 1980s.
The whole show, the concept is the brainstorming process of getting you off the ground. Eventually, I'd love for some of our listeners to submit works for the show, come in on the show, discuss it. And the value here that we hope that you find is the inspirational process of just taking these old nuggets and morphing them or twisting them or whatever, and then weaving seemingly disparate concepts together in such a way as that makes an interesting or compelling story.
And I don't believe that anyone's ever done a movie about Germain.
You mentioned that there was a guy that wrote a script, and it was eerily similar to the legend of Germain.
Yeah, so Ken Russell, who did The Devils, very controversial film with, what was it, Oliver Reed? Wasn't Oliver Reed the actor that was always drunk? I think that's him, Oliver Reed.
I think there's a lot of them.
Yeah. I'm pretty sure it was Oliver Reed in The Devils with Ken Russell. Well, Ken Russell wanted to do his own version of Dracula, and his version of Dracula really seemed to have cherry-picked from the Germain legend, in that Dracula was just an artist who would reinvent himself every 100 years, and he kind of just implied that he had been various famous artists over his lifetime. And so it just sounds very similar to Germain, so it kind of made me wonder if it was just maybe Russell had heard that legend and applied it to Dracula. But what I was going to say is, if someone did make a movie about Germain, you never know if it's true, he could just come and play himself.
Oh, that'd be quite interesting. And you did bring up the idea that there was rumors around Nicolas Cage.
There's this old Civil War era photograph of a guy who looks identical to Nicolas Cage, and then tie in with that Nicolas Cage has already built his own mausoleum for when he dies, and people like to basically claim that maybe Nick Cage is a vampire.
Speculation is wild and ripe on the internet. All sorts of interesting conspiracy theories.
And we probably have people that listen to us, not really for the stories we make up, but just because we expose them to this weird hidden history they've never heard of before.
I would hope that the value of the show goes beyond our jibber-jabbering. All right, so we are on time, folks. I'm here with John LeMay, author of over 40 books, including the books that we've kind of pulled here from today. John?
Yeah, the book we pulled from quite a bit today is called Cowboys and Vampires, The Undead in North America. There's not really a lot of cowboys in the book, to be honest, but it's just those stories from between, let's say, the 1850s to the 1950s on allegedly real-life vampire encounters.
And that is volume one of a set of three here.
Yeah, I did a trilogy. So the second book is called Mummies of the Americas, which is basically about really interesting mummies. Like there's one of John Wilkes Booth that was allegedly cursed. Then the last book is called Cowboys and Dogmen, which is same thing, but with real life werewolves. So if you like, you know, these potentially true stories, you know, I've collected all the best ones in this little trilogy here.
You run out to Amazon.com.
Mm-hmm.
We'll have the link in the description below. And if you are interested, go check it out. In the meantime, William Atkinson here with John LeMay on Plot Pit. Until next time.